So why is vitamin D important? Well, vitamin D status, your circulating level of vitamin D, is strongly linked to longevity. There have been some studies recently that have looked at the level of vitamin D correlated to your risk of dying from any cause. And the higher the level of vitamin D, the lower your risk of all-cause mortality. Meaning, the higher the level of vitamin D, the longer you're likely to live. So longevity would be reason enough, but it won't be by the time you finish hearing everything that I share with you. Longevity is great, but vitamin D levels are also linked to reduced risk of deadly cancers, heart disease, diabetes, prediabetes, which is insulin resistance, autoimmune diseases like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, depression, obesity, hypertension, dementia, infection rates for flu, colds, tuberculosis, and of course, the bone diseases, osteoporosis, osteomalacia in adults, rickets in children. It's a very broad array, and if you think about it, it's all over the body. So vitamin D has got to be critically important. In the cells, there are vitamin D receptors. And the vitamin D, either as 25-OHD or as the hormone calcitriol, locks onto the vitamin D receptor and activates either the action of that part of the cell or organelle, or switches on or switches off genes that activate a number of different reactions. It's estimated that there are more than 2,000 genes that are switched on or off by vitamin D. And the number of cells with vitamin D receptors, the list is growing every day. We discover every day new populations of cells that actually have vitamin D receptors. There are cells in the intestine, there are cells in all the muscles, the bone-building cells, the osteoblasts, cells in the parathyroid, in the pancreas, so cells in the endocrine system, the ovaries, the breasts, the prostate, so cells in all the reproductive tissue, immune cells like monocytes and macrophages and B cells and T cells have vitamin D receptors. In the brain, the neurons have vitamin D receptors. This wouldn't be the case. There would not be vitamin D receptors all over the body in practically every organ system if vitamin D wasn't fundamental for good health. So it's clear that vitamin D status, when it's compromised, is not allowing for the best level of activity of cells, tissues, and organs, or in some cases, responses such as immune response. So given the ubiquitous nature of the vitamin D receptors everywhere in the body and the numbers of new cells that are being identified every day and the genes, it's clear that vitamin D is fundamental to good health. Vitamin D also plays a special role in supporting mood and neurological well-being, and so I wanted to talk about a couple of studies that have to do with either the presence of active mood disorders or benefit for information processing. But first, I want to say that a study was, an interesting to me study, was done in Miami, and it was among women who were 70 years old, average age, and men, average age 68, who were undergoing either total hip or knee replacement. Now, it was Miami, and it was late summer in Miami, and you think that it's a very sunny place, and it certainly isn't vitamin D winter, so it'd be unlikely that there would be a significant number of them that would be deficient. But they ran the vitamin D levels on these women and men who were getting ready to have an orthopedic surgery, and what they found was 85% of them were found to have vitamin D deficiency. So that, I just want to say that to make the point that older people in particular, but even people in very sunny climates, are coming in and being tested and being found to have vitamin D deficiency. So with the idea that in an elderly population, 85% of them were deficient, I want to go to psychiatric and neurologic disorders. Vitamin D deficiency is common in older adults, and it's been implicated in psychiatric and neurologic disorders. And so One study took a look at vitamin D status and cognitive performance and mood and also physical performance in older adults. The average vitamin D level in the total sample of all of the adults in this study was 18 nanograms per milliliter. So that is a deficiency. 20 or less is deficiency. And so after adjusting for other factors like age and race and gender and season of vitamin D exposure, those who were deficient in this study had an 11-fold increased incidence of presently having an active mood disorder. So depression or dementia or some kind of issue relating to mood and cognitive function, the poorer performance, the worse cognitive performance, and the low mood was directly correlated to vitamin D levels, and the people with deficiency had an 11-fold increased incidence. This is not risk of. There were 1,100% higher numbers of people that had an active mood disorder. So the idea that we could have normal brain function, optimal mood, and poor vitamin D status just doesn't hold. We obviously need to have a correct amount of vitamin D in the body. And vitamin D in other studies has been correlated with seasonal affective disorder. That makes sense. In the winter, when we're not getting vitamin D exposure and our vitamin D levels are very low, we are more likely to have problems with mood. Most recently, in May of 2009, there was a study that took a look at vitamin D levels and intellectual performance in males, adult males. And they found essentially the same thing that we saw in the earlier study. The lower the vitamin D level, the poorer the reasoning, the problem solving, and the intellectual performance in adult males, and the idea was comparing the lowest quartile to the highest quartile. And they found significant problems with intellectual function in people that had deficiency levels of vitamin D. So what are we saying? If most of us are deficient, are we basically running on empty? Are we all in some kind of compromised state when it comes to cognitive function or mood? I think that we might find out that things would be much sunnier mood-wise, and maybe we'd be a lot sharper if we were all able to get our vitamin D levels up to a level of adequacy. 30 nanograms or milliliter or better might sharpen all of us up quite a bit. We have a real issue in our culture right now with an increased rate of diabetes. The diagnosis of new diabetics in the last 10 years has increased by 90%. It's estimated that in the U.S., children born after the year 2000, 1 out of 3 will become a type 2 diabetic in their lifetime. There's a role for vitamin D with diabetes and the pre-diabetes condition called metabolic syndrome. Vitamin D may be protective. Normal insulin secretion is vitamin D dependent. That's an area in the body where there are vitamin D receptors. The pancreas, the islet cells that produce insulin, have vitamin D receptors, and adequate vitamin D ramps up the insulin production. The other area is with insulin receptors in the cells. Low vitamin D status contributes to both insulin resistance and the reduction of the insulin secretion. Insulin resistance is that condition where the insulin receptors are not picking up the combination of insulin and glucose and escorting the glucose then into the cell to be used as fuel. And insulin resistance, it's another name for metabolic syndrome, it's pre-diabetes. If the body is losing its handle on metabolizing glucose as fuel, that loss, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, results in a few things. It results in an increase in glucose in the bloodstream, circulating glucose, an increase in circulating insulin levels in the bloodstream. It results in the glucose being stored as fat rather than burned as fuel. So triglyceride elevation. Triglycerides are the storage molecule of fats that have been converted from glucose. And elevated triglycerides are associated with insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. So vitamin D is protective on many different fronts in just normalizing the metabolism of the fuels that we eat and helping to look at what's going on in the body, what changes are happening that lead to insulin resistance, accumulation of body fat, which in a feedback loop increases insulin resistance, and then ultimately the development of type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is linked to vitamin D also. That is an autoimmune type of diabetes where the body just isn't producing enough insulin. The pancreas, the immune system actually attacks the part of the pancreas that produces insulin. It's an aberrant immune response. And so the pancreas is destroyed to some extent and the insulin production is inadequate and these people are insulin dependent diabetics. That's type 1 diabetes. There was a fascinating study that was started in the 1960s in Finland, and they looked at babies. There were 12,000 babies that were followed into their 30s. Now, this is a country that has a different kind of healthcare system, and so they actually have medical records that are quite different than we have here in the United States, and they also have different approaches about intervention. So the 12,000 babies were chosen because they were babies that were estimated to be at high risk for type 1 diabetes because of their family history. And what they did was an intervention where they supplemented with 2,000 units of vitamin D daily during the first year of the baby's life in half of the babies, and half of the babies did not get vitamin D. And what they found was in the vitamin D supplemented children, there was a reduction in incidence of type 1 diabetes by more than 80%. If they got the vitamin D every day, the entire first year, there was actually an 88% lower incidence of type 1 diabetes all the way out into age 30. And the supplementation was only the first year. If it was a sporadic supplementation, there was still at least an 80% reduced incidence of type 1 diabetes in these babies. And this brings up a bunch of different things. The first thing is, how amazing is it that they were giving 2,000 units of vitamin D to newborns in the 60s? It shines a light on the inappropriate levels of vitamin D that we've been recommending for children and adults ever since then, looking at 200 units or 400 units as a recommendation. In our culture right now, we're recommending 400 units for newborns and children all the way to age 19, and in fact, also adults, and we don't go any higher than that until people get to be senior citizens, and then we only recommend 600 units. Some family doctors are recommending 800 units based on those bone and fall studies, but the official recommendations are completely out of sync with the science that has emerged over the past several decades. So you saw these babies that grew up and had a significantly lower incidence of an autoimmune condition, type 1 diabetes. Another study in Norway found that giving a mother cod liver oil during pregnancy reduced the risk of both types of diabetes in the offspring. And you know, cod liver oil is a source of vitamin D3. So there's a connection with vitamin D and diabetes. There's also a connection with vitamin D and multiple sclerosis. Vitamin D may help prevent the development and the progression of MS. And MS is a situation where there's a damage to the myelin covering around nerve cells. And when MS patients are screened for bone health, it turns out in one big study that 77% of them were vitamin D deficient. Thus, 3 out of 4 MS patients have very low levels of vitamin D. Another study was the nurses study. It's another Harvard study, and they found that nurses that took supplemental vitamin D 400 units daily were 40% less likely to develop MS. The connection has to do with inhibition of inflammatory processes. Vitamin D is actually an anti-inflammatory. And this demyelinating, the destruction, the debilitating of the central nervous system because of the ripping apart of the myelin sheath around the nerves is caused by an inappropriate immune response that is basically carried out by T cells and their pro-inflammatory immune cells. Inflammation can be a good thing when you're mounting an immune response, when you're mounting it against something that's actually dangerous. But when it's our own tissues, it's a problem. Well, vitamin D inhibits the inflammatory T helper cell attack on myelin sheath, and it helps to enhance the production of anti-inflammatory compounds in the body. So there seems to be an interventional benefit in giving daily supplementation with vitamin D in multiple sclerosis patients, and we're going to probably see a lot more about MS and vitamin D as we go forward into the next decade or so. The final area with autoimmune that I want to talk about is rheumatoid arthritis. And here the immune system is mounting an immune response against, unfortunately, connective tissue in our joints and in our joint capsules. So you have an infiltration, again, of T lymphocytes, but also macrophages and plasma cells into the synovial membranes in the joints. It initiates a chronic inflammatory state. We get an overproduction of pro-inflammatory factors, tumor necrosis F, interleukin 6, are examples of those. Also, elevated levels of C-reactive protein, which is a biochemical indicator of inflammation. What does all this have to do with vitamin D? Well, vitamin D helps to guard against the inappropriate T lymphocyte function. It helps to guard against the production of those pro-inflammatory cytokines. It reduces the interleukin 6. It reduces levels of elevated C-reactive protein. And what all of this means is the chemistry is changing in favor of healthier joints. So would that mean that rheumatoid arthritis patients have low levels of vitamin D? Yes. The 60% or better of rheumatoid arthritis patients have levels that are less than 20 nanograms per milliliter. So the majority are deficient. And an interesting thing is that you see less progression of disease as the vitamin D levels increase. And in at least animal studies, the vitamin D hormone, calcitriol, is able to significantly suppress disease activity in mice and other animal models of rheumatoid arthritis. So low levels are associated with an increase in the disease. Better levels correct some of the bad chemistry of the disease, and at least in animals, intervention has been effective as a treatment. So there's a lot of exciting information probably coming to us with rheumatoid arthritis. In closing, I think it's clear that the issue is not whether you should take vitamin D. Of course, all of us want to maintain an optimal level of vitamin D. So the issue is, since vitamin D does not occur in abundant levels in food, and most of us are being very careful about sunlight exposure, supplements seem to be the safest and most efficient way to maintain optimal levels. So how do you choose a supplement? What are you going to choose? Well, you do have a number of different choices. Cod liver oil is usually a good source of vitamin D, but you have to check your label to be certain that your cod liver oil provides vitamin D because some of them don't. A minimum amount in cod liver oil should be 400 units per teaspoon, and there's even a cod liver oil called Super D Omega 3 by Carlson that provides 2,000 units per teaspoon. So that's a nice one. It provides a daily dose of omega-3s and a good dose of vitamin D. It's lemon flavored, it tastes good, and you can mix it in food. If you don't want to do cod liver oil, soft gels are another way to go. There are a lot of different soft gel vitamin D supplements on the market. Just make sure it's vitamin D3. Solar D Gems is a great one from Carlson, and those are available in strengths up to 4,000 units a day. And then there are even vitamin D drops, and vitamin D drops are available in several different strengths. Carlson makes them in a 400-unit dose for babies and young children, a 1,000-unit dose for older children, and 2,000 units for adolescents and adults. So what should your daily dose be? Well, you want to get to 40 nanograms per milliliter. And for the largest number of people, the dose that will get you there is 4,000 units daily. And that's 4,000 units in addition to whatever vitamin D is in your multivitamin, in addition to what you're getting from the sunlight that you are getting, and in addition to the vitamin D that's in the foods that you eat. So a 4,000-unit dose is the daily amount that will get the majority of people to 40 nanograms per milliliter. It's a perfectly safe dose. Anything up to 10,000 units a day is considered a safe dose, and 4,000 units is well within the safety range for vitamin D. Remember that toxicity doesn't start until 150 nanograms per milliliter, and that would require a dose of 50,000 units on a daily basis for 1 to 2 months. The optimal level of vitamin D can only be absolutely assured if you are getting a vitamin D test periodically. But until you do get tested, for adults, I'm recommending 4,000 units a day. I really appreciate you taking time to listen today, and I hope that this information has been helpful for you. Feel free with any of my CDs to make copies and to share them with your friends and family members so that they can get the message and they can take advantage of this information about preventive medicine too. If you've listened to any of my work on fish oils, on vitamin E, any of my radio programs, you know that I have a really strong interest in heart health. The whole reason for my career came about because of the unfortunate early demise of my dad. My dad died from a sudden heart attack at the age of 42. And it shifted my direction in life, and it gave me a reason for going forward into this career. It certainly gave me purpose. But it also gave me a belief that people were dying needlessly of sudden cardiac death and many other types of cardiovascular events. So why do I say needless? Because some of these things are preventable. There are either things that we can take that reduce risk, or there's knowledge about low levels of certain nutrients that increases risk. And vitamin D is one of those. So what we know is that low levels of vitamin D increase our risk of heart attack. We know this based on a number of different studies. Here's one that was published in the latter part of 2008. Now, this is the Physician's Health Study, and it involves 51,000 people. So there's a great number of people in this trial, and they've measured their vitamin D levels and have been following them for a long time. This is Ed Giovannucci at Harvard School of Public Health. Very respectable group of people with medical records and blood samples of people who have had non-fatal heart attack, fatal heart disease, and they've been following these people since 1993 and comparing with men that are healthy that have not had a history of cardiovascular disease. So here is what the finding was. Men with a vitamin D deficiency, meaning 15 nanograms per milliliter, had twice the risk for heart attack compared with those having 30 nanograms per milliliter or higher. And after adjusting for other risk factors like high cholesterol or hypertension or obesity, men that had intermediate vitamin D levels were at higher risk than the men with sufficient levels. So anywhere between 15 and 30 nanograms per milliliter was associated with risk. Men didn't really get to the point of having half the risk until they got to that 30 nanogram or higher level. And that's just one study that was published in 2008. Another one was from the Framingham Heart Study. This is a group of people that have been followed for quite some time now. We've gotten a lot of information about cardiovascular disease and associated risks. And here the finding was basically the same. What happened was that the patients with vitamin D levels below 15 nanograms per milliliter were twice as likely to have not just a heart attack, but a stroke or any other cardiovascular event. And here they qualified it. It was likely to happen within the next 5 years. Framingham also found that low vitamin D levels, 25 OHD levels, were directly linked to cardiovascular disease risk factors such as hypertension, obesity, and diabetes, meaning low vitamin D puts you at a greater risk for high blood pressure, for being overweight, or for the development of diabetes. Looking at 2008 alone, all of the different studies seem to have the same direction as far as findings go. Giovannucci found men with adequate D at half the risk for heart attack. Framingham found not just heart attack, but stroke and non-fatal heart attack. Other studies found a reduction in risk for peripheral artery disease. The lower the 25-OHD, the higher the risk of peripheral artery disease. Other studies found that low 25-OHD was associated with hypertension. Another one found calcified aorta. Another one found walking difficulty in heart failure patients. The lower their levels of vitamin D, the more stressed they were, and the less amount of time they could walk on a treadmill. So we're looking at associations that explain partly the reason why we have such an epidemic of deaths from heart disease, because we now know that we basically have most of the population deficient in vitamin D, and that the levels that we're maintaining either in the winter or even in the summer are associated with twice the risk for heart attack, stroke, hypertension. We have long known that there was a correlation between sunlight exposure and hypertension. The farther away you live from the equator, the bigger your risk for elevated blood pressure. And this is an issue. Now, most people just jump onto a blood pressure medication, but the blood pressure medications do not come without side effects. And there are some major side effects with blood pressure medications. Fatigue and dizziness, persistent cough is an issue, frequent urination for some people because they're on diuretics, fluid retention for some people is an issue, and a big one is sexual dysfunction. This one has delivered more clients to my door than probably any other medication side effect in my entire career. Turns out, in men, antihypertensives actually make it more difficult to have an erection, and that men might be resistant to the idea of prevention on many fronts, but when it comes to sexual performance, they might be willing to think about taking supplements rather than drugs. And that is a practical adverse effect that really gets the attention of a lot of people, but know that this is also true. Beta blockers, which are one of the major classifications of medication for hypertension, have been shown to double the death risk from heart attacks and congestive heart failure and other major cardiovascular events. And therein, there's a perfect example of the irony of allopathic medicine. Very often, the medications that we're taking to manage a specific effect of a disease or a condition actually put us at higher risk of that very same disease. So there's an irony there that's not lost on me, and it's another reason why I strongly advocate for prevention rather than just jumping into a handful of pharmaceutical products. Probably the best known area of vitamin D and health is bone health. Vitamin D regulates calcium metabolism, and vitamin D deficiencies are well noted in people who have osteoporosis. In fact, vitamin D deficiency in general was defined as the disease rickets. When children had very low levels of vitamin D, they would be born with bone deformities. But deficiencies correlate also with poor coordination and muscle weakness, and they also cause osteomalacia, which is soft bones, osteopenia, which is bone pain, and also chronic muscle pain. And here's something to think about, especially if you're Medicare age. Medicare will pay for a vitamin D level assessment for you if you have a history of fracture or complaints of chronic bone or muscle pain. They approve then the vitamin D level testing. Vitamin D testing is not all that expensive, but if you can get it paid for, it's a good thing. Now, here's a study that is really worth mentioning because so many people are suffering from chronic pain. In 2008, a researcher did an analysis, 22 different studies on the relationship of vitamin D deficiency and chronic pain. And in total, in this particular analysis, there were almost 4,000 patients that had chronic pain. Half of them had significant vitamin D deficiency, but here's the cool part. So they gave them vitamin D. The study actually became an intervention. And vitamin D supplementation was very helpful in alleviating the pain. When the supplementation was provided and it improved their vitamin D status, so meaningful amount of vitamin D, meaning that, pain and or muscle weakness were resolved or at least subsided in the majority of the cases, and there were associated improvements in physical functioning. So this is different because it's not just a case of low vitamin D being associated with increased rate of a problem. This is also a case of then give them vitamin D and see if something happens, and it did. Another area that's related to this is bone and muscle strength. In this case, people that are older fall down more often. People that are older begin to have problems with something called sway. The large muscles in their legs become more weak, more flaccid, lose tone, and when they are just a little bit off balance, stepping off of a curb or just swaying in general, the older people have a tendency to sway a little bit side to side when they walk. And it's very easy to fall down. Falling down leads to fractures, and fractures, in particular hip fractures, are the leading cause of admission into nursing homes and present a tremendous cost to us in society. So the analysis was a couple thousand people, actually closer to 3,000 people, age 65 to 85, who were given monthly doses during the winter of 100,000 units of vitamin D per day. And what happened was a reduced risk of general fracture and a more significantly reduced risk of fracture at the common fracture sites, the wrist and the hip. And so the thing that was interesting about this was that it was a monthly dose. That's the reduction in fractures is interesting, but also a thing to say about vitamin D is that it doesn't even have to be taken on a daily basis. We talk about daily doses. Most people supplement using a daily dose approach. But in hospitals, in nursing homes, vitamin D may be given on a weekly basis and sometimes even on a monthly basis with much larger amounts. So you could, if you were using something like a vitamin D drop, for example, you could take them all on the weekend and be done with it for the week. That doesn't always work out. Some researchers feel that more intermittent dosing leads to higher compliance. My experience has been that people forget about it. Let's say Saturday's your day, maybe you're going to forget. But because that 25-OHD circulates and has a 60-day half-life, it increases slowly, so it takes a while. When you increase your dose of vitamin D, it's going to take a while. It's a slow climb to get the level up, but that means it also decreases slowly. So you could take it weekly and you would not have any difference in terms of maintaining a level. And in that study, they gave even a monthly dose. You could do it that way. Here's a study of women who were average age 85, and they gave them 1,200 milligrams of calcium and 800 units of vitamin D. And this is what happened: a 69% reduced risk of hip fracture. Also, their bone density was stabilized during the supplemental period, and their parathyroid hormone levels returned to normal after 6 months. And it was a 6-month study. Now, what is that, parathyroid hormone? That is the mechanism by which vitamin D governs bone density. Vitamin D turns into calcitriol, and calcitriol actually stimulates parathyroid hormone levels to normalize, in this case, not to increase the parathyroid hormone levels, but to decrease them. When we have low vitamin D status, hand in hand with that is elevated parathyroid hormone. And when parathyroid hormone is elevated, it pulls the calcium out of the bones. Now, in allopathy, the common approach to weak bones, if you have a bone scan and it's not what you want it to be, very often, the answer in traditional medicine is more calcium. They just keep increasing the calcium. Our daily values for calcium have increased steadily during my career. And we're at this point now where women that are beyond menopause are suggested to take 1,500 milligrams of calcium every day. The reason why the calcium levels are climbing and climbing is because the vitamin D status has been declining. The daily values for vitamin D were reduced in the 1960s, and the reduction in vitamin D daily value recommendations led to people taking less vitamin D. And what has happened is we've had a steady decline in vitamin D status, and that necessitates an increase in the calcium that we have to take. If we can get people to a point where their vitamin D level normalizes parathyroid hormone, theoretically at least, we might be able to take quite a bit less calcium. And what is that level? 32 nanograms per milliliter. And that's why that is, for me personally, the bottom line. If you were working with me directly as a nutrition client, I would not accept a level of vitamin D, 25-OHD, that was below 32 nanograms per milliliter. Now, yes, you heard me say that at 30, you have half the heart attack risk, and that's something to celebrate, absolutely. But as we get older, we get into an issue where bone risks are hugely important to us. So I use 32 as my bottom line because it is at 32 that parathyroid hormone levels normalize. So what do you have to take to get to 32? On the average, most people, counting that they're already taking a multivitamin and maybe a bone formula, will need to take 2,000 to 3,000 units a day of vitamin D3 separately on top of the diet, the sunlight, and the multi and the bone formula to get to 32 or better. That's going to normalize the parathyroid hormone. That's going to give you the fall benefit. The fall benefit requires quite a bit less. 800 units is really all you need in order to stay upright. Your risk of falling down declines significantly as long as you're maintaining 800 units or better. So you see, that's really a tiny dose. It's not a dose I recommend. It's not enough, but that dose is at least enough to keep you on your feet if you're an older person. Now, two more areas that involve muscle and bone health involve females. The first one is risk of C-sections. Vitamin D levels have been linked to other pregnancy issues, infection in the placenta. The lower the level, the more likely it's the case. Bacterial vaginosis was a new study that just came out in pregnant women. The lower your vitamin D level, the higher the likelihood that you have this bacterial infection in the vagina. Preeclampsia, which is a dangerous hypertension situation, low vitamin D. We know that vitamin D is linked to hypertension, but also during pregnancy for preeclampsia. But another one is C-section, and you know that a lot of people opt to have a C-section thinking that it's easier, they can time the birth the way that they want to, that it's a predictable event, but no one can really honestly believe that a cesarean is the normal way to give birth, and here in the United States, up to a third of all births are by cesarean section. So something's wrong, and this is not even talking about the scheduling of C-sections. This is people that go in thinking that they're going to have a vaginal birth and end up with a C-section. And the something in most cases is likely vitamin D deficiency, and for two good reasons. The first one is loss of muscle strength. So weak muscle tone, birth requires some pretty good muscle effort, and so weak muscle tone is an issue. And research looking at C-sections pointed out that women with low levels of vitamin D had four times the risk of cesarean section compared to women with higher levels. But another issue is just the shape of the pelvis. One of the classical presentations of rickets is pelvic abnormality, where the pelvis is narrow and the pelvic opening is not sufficient to permit the passing through of the baby. So if you look at that, that kind of gives us a hint about what happened back in the 1600s, the 1700s, the 1800s, and right up until this day with women who die in childbirth when there isn't adequate intervention available. That lack of ability for the labor to progress and for that baby to move through the pelvis into the birth canal often has to do with a narrowing of the pelvis, which is really an association of adult rickets. Now, also younger women, adolescent girls, have muscle issues that relate to vitamin D as well. There was a great study that just came out looking at vitamin D and muscle tone of young women between the ages of 12 and 14. And the better their vitamin D levels, the better their muscle tone, the stronger they were athletically. In this case, these kids were athletes. Now, that also segues back to the bones. We want to build in women, in particular, the strongest bones that we can during the adolescent stage of life. We need to be paying very close attention to vitamin D status in our daughters, because during adolescence, if we build the strongest bones, if we have really good, strong bones, very good dynamic bone health during adolescence, we have a dramatically lower risk of osteoporosis for the rest of that person's life. So it's not too soon to be thinking about vitamin D testing with young women starting around age 10 in order to make sure that she has great muscle tone. Of course, everyone wants that. But also, let's build the bones. Let's build the bones during the phase of life where we really are meant to be building the strong bones, and then enjoy the benefit of that for the rest of her life.